On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Michael Tim about his new book, Resurrecting Leonora Piper.
You know, I think there's two ways we can look at all this information about this period. We can look at it in terms of forgotten history, which is, I think, the angle that you take, you know. But I gotta wonder if there isn't a totally different way of looking at this history. And that's almost like a textbook game plan for the kind of scientism, for the kind of spirit of denial that we live in today. I mean, it's almost like, hey, if you want to look at how to take overwhelmingly significant evidence and bury it, sweep it under the rug, and embarrass all the people who've touched it, here's the way to do it. Just go back and look at this part of history.
I agree. I mean, that's one of the reasons I wrote this book and four other books that I've written, is to try and resurrect this stuff because it's so little known. I know a number of parapsychologists, I've talked to a number of parapsychologists, and they don't know it themselves. That, you know, I remember one who didn't even know who Frederick Myers was. And you talk about Leonora Piper or Sir Oliver Lodge or Gladys Osborne Leonard, and they're all names they recognize, but they don't know any of the history.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, we welcome back Michael Tim to talk about his new book, Resurrecting Leonora Piper, and to explore this fascinating part of history of a little more than 100 years ago. You know, I'm a big fan of history. I love the perspective it gives us on our modern, everyday world. And I think that's especially true of the kind of work that Mike Tim has done with this early part of the 1900s, because what really jumps out at me is how smart these people are. You know, we tend to think that we're so smart and advanced and we have Google and our phones and all that stuff. And then you go back and you read how these people spoke and how they wrote, and you feel, at least I do, like these people aren't my equals. They're my superiors in terms of intellectual firepower. And I hope you'll prove that yourself by picking up a copy of Michael Tim's latest book, Resurrecting Leonora Piper, or any of his previous books, or you can go and just read the original works by William James and Frederick Myers and all the rest. And I think you'll come away equally impressed. But let's get on to the interview that I just had with Mike Tim on his latest book, Resurrecting Leonora Piper. Here goes. Today we welcome Michael Tim to Skeptico. Mike is the author of several books relating to afterlife communication and mediumship, including The Articulate Dead, The Afterlife Revealed, and his latest that we're going to talk about today, Resurrecting Leonora Piper, How Science Discovered the Afterlife. It's a book published by White Crow Books, which is a place where you'll also find Mike's excellent blog. Mike, welcome back to Skeptico. It's great to talk to you again.
Thank you very much for having me on, Alex.
So you've written this book about Leonora Piper, someone who many people who are interested in mediumship and history in general might know, but I think there's a lot of people who don't know who Leonora Piper was, so I guess that's the natural place to start.
Okay, Leonora Piper was an American woman born in Nashua, New Hampshire in 1859. She discovered her mediumistic ability sometime around 1883 when she was 24 at the time. Her father-in-law had suggested that she see a psychic healer for some problem that she was having at the time. And while she was seeing the psychic healer, she dropped off into a trance and she started giving information to another person in the room, a doctor, about his deceased son. So that's how she came to realize that she had mediumistic ability. And then she started experimenting with it now and then with friends. And then somewhere along the line that first year, William James's mother, William James being professor of psychology at Harvard, she had a sitting with Leonora and found it very evidential and told her husband, William James, all about it. So William James had his own sitting and was very much impressed. And as a result, he signed up Leonora to be a research subject for the next 18 years or so.
Okay, and I still feel, and it's Leonora, so I apologize for that. I'll have to do that correctly from here on out. But I do feel we need to lay the backdrop here, right? I mean, because she goes on to become the White Crow that many people will know, who know William James, know that his famous quote about there being, there only needs to be one White Crow to prove not all crows are black. And he's really talking about psychic ability and ability to talk with the dead. But the time frame that we're really talking about here and the backdrop of that is interesting, because we're coming out of a period with Darwinism, with reason, with a move away from religious thought into this explosion of scientific free thought. And now here are these folks at the same time who start getting this inkling that this spiritualism might have some real legs to it. Can you fill in some of the history gaps that I'm leaving out there?
Sure. First of all, as far as Mrs. Piper's first name, it's either Leonora or Lenore. Lenore was her nickname and Leonora was her full name, so either one is correct on that. But as far as psychical research, formal psychical research didn't really begin until 1882, when the Society for Psychical Research was formed in London, and then 3 years later, it was the American branch was also formed. But it really goes back to the 11th century, I guess you could say, when the Catholic Church was setting down formal guidelines for investigation of miracles involving saints. And then we jump up to 1741, thereabouts, when Emanuel Swedenborg was doing his own personal investigation of afterlife realms by means of clairvoyant and out-of-body experiences or whatever he was doing. He was going into the heavens and reporting on it. It wasn't research with anybody else, but it was his own personal research. And Swedenborg is sometimes called the first spiritualist. Then we jump up to key event on March 31st, 1848, which was the Fox sisters in Hydesville, New York. That sort of kicked everything off. I'm sure many of your listeners have heard that story and their questions about it. But in effect, they heard knocks around the house, and they had been hearing them for a number of weeks. And all of a sudden, these two young girls realized that they could communicate with the knocks. They'd get three knocks and they'd knock back a certain number of times and get the same number of knocks back. And then they realized that if they asked a question and said, you know, give me three knocks for a yes and one knock for a no or something to that effect, that they could get an intelligent response. So they called this to the attention of their parents, and the parents experimented, and it just took off from there. Not only in Hydesville, New York, but within a year, this was going on all around the world, and at least the Western world, and people started looking into it. And one of the first who looked into it was Judge John Edmonds, who was a Supreme Court justice in New York. He was probably the first real psychical researcher. Edmonds sat with dozens of mediums. He thought it was all bunk initially, but he soon came to believe it, and he wrote the first real book on psychical research called Spiritualism. And then there are several others in the 1850s. Robert Hare, who's a professor of chemistry at the University of Pennsylvania, he got into it because he wanted to debunk it. He thought it was just so much, quote, madness. And he was out to put a stop to it, but he became a believer after sitting with 22 or 23 different mediums. And then over in France, there was Alan Kardec. He was conducting his own investigation, and he also became a believer. And then we go into the 1860s, and we've got Alfred Russel Wallace, who was a co-originator with Charles Darwin of the natural selection theory, and he was a total skeptic, and after sitting with a number of mediums, he also joined the believers. And then up into 1870, that's when the founders of the SPR, the Society for Psychical Research, began to take an interest in the matter. Frederick Myers, who was a lecturer at Cambridge, a poet, his friend Edmund Gurney, and Henry Sidgwick, they became interested, started sitting with mediums, and then in 1882 they decided we need a formal peer review group to take a look at this material. That pretty much kicked off formal psychical research. But as far as the times were concerned, it should be pointed out that the 1870s was really a time of despair. Myers talks about this quite a bit, and William James does too, that it took about 10 years for Darwinism to really kick in. And that resulted, even before Darwinism, as you know, it was the age of reason, the age of enlightenment, and so forth. People were falling away from the churches, and Darwinism was sort of the knockout blow. People felt, if the world wasn't created the way the Bible says, then the whole Bible must be wrong. And this resulted in many people, especially the educated people, falling away from the church and having nothing else to fall back on. And as a result, there was a lot of what William James called soul sickness. In fact, James himself said he suffered from soul sickness at the time and had considered committing suicide.
Does James and do other intellectuals at that time, do they make that connection between this kind of nihilistic, atheistic movement that's going on that's behind Darwinism and this soul sickness or this malaise that's kind of falling over people? Is the connection understood at that point?
They understood. I mean, they were looking for meaning to life, a meaning in life that had seemed to have disappeared with Darwinism and the downfall of the church. And they don't always come out and say that, we're looking for evidence of the survival of consciousness at death. In fact, the SPR, when it was formed in 1882, they carefully avoided saying that they're looking for evidence for survival. They said they were looking into telepathy, mental or thought transference was the term they gave it then, which is really, later named telepathy.
And Mike, and I think you point this out in your book, but correct me if I'm wrong, part of the reason they're going down the telepathy route when they're first investigating these mediums, it sounds almost so current, it's a repeat of so much of the research that's been going on in the last 20 years, and that's that it's more scientifically acceptable in kind of a strange way to say, it's this ESP thing that we don't understand, than to say it's this survival of consciousness thing that we don't understand. Do I have that right, or is that not quite?
Yeah, I think that's the case. It's just more, and still more scientifically acceptable today to talk about telepathy than it is to talk about survival.
Even to the point where a lot of NDE researchers won't go there when the connection is even more obvious. I mean, I still don't understand how you can talk about near-death experience research and not immediately jump to at least dealing with some of the philosophical issues concerning survival. But yet that's where a lot of folks feel they need to go and dance around that whole survival issue. So this was also very much on the minds of these researchers, in particular William James, as he started this research at Harvard in 1885. Is that right?
That's right.
You told us just a minute ago how this research starts, but maybe go over that period again. What is James trying to do? And then he locks on to Leonora Piper. And then where does it go from there?
Well, Leonora Piper was probably the best medium that he had come across, at least in the United States, or a couple in England that other people were looking at. But he didn't have time to do an extensive study with Leonora Piper, so he helped organize the American branch of the Society for Psychical Research, and they brought in Dr. Richard Hodgson, who was an Australian who was lecturing in England. He was primarily a law professor, and in England he had debunked a number of mediums and also went to India and supposedly debunked Madame Blavatsky. So he pretty much assumed that Hodgson was going to debunk Piper.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because this is a fascinating aspect of this, especially when Hodgkin comes back later in this story, both literally comes back and figuratively comes back into the story. Here's a guy who, as you just mentioned, goes into this with kind of a track record of shooting down these mediums, going in and scientifically or from with a legal background that he has, saying, I know enough to find the fraud, find the trickery, and expose it. And it's not like he's opposed to doing this research. He just doesn't believe that it's possibly true. And he's the perfect guy for James to kind of tap to go and say, look at my white crow here and show me if she's legit, right?
Right. Hodgson had an open mind, I think, and I can't think of the person's name offhand who was really president of the SPR, American branch of the SPR at the time, but he was out to debunk Mrs. Piper, too. His brother had been taken by a medium, and he thought it was all bunk, and I think he had more of a more to do with choosing Hodgson than James did.
Interesting. Tell us a little bit about that first reading Hodgson gets with Lenora Piper. You documented in the book, and it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, well, I should explain. Mrs. Piper went into a trance. I mean, people don't realize it. They think of mediums today. They see John Edward and Lisa Williams and James Von Prague and so forth on the television, and they think that clairvoyant-type mediumship represents all of the old mediumship. When it doesn't, it's really quite a bit different. Mrs. Piper was a trans medium. She would sit down and take her a minute or two to go into a trance state. Her eyes would roll back into her head, and all of a sudden, you know, her voice would change if it was a male. So that's what Hodgson was looking at, this woman speaking to him in another voice. And the voice in this case was that of Fred, his boyhood playmate. And Fred gave some little details as to what, you know, they did when they were boys playing leapfrog. And Fred actually had a fatal injury when he was, I don't know, 14 or something like that. And there were other evidential details. I don't recall all of them right now, but that got Hodgson to thinking maybe there is something to this.
You know, Mike, it's interesting. I just finished an interview with Dr. Julie Beischel, who you know, of course, and you wrote a nice blurb for her recent book. But in talking to Julie, we were talking about this topic of your first reading and a reading with a medium who gives you information that's just highly evidential that just makes you go, whoa, there is just no way. And it's usually personal information. And that's how it was with Hodgson, too. He touches on some of the information from his first love that he doesn't even want to share, but it obviously affects him deeply. And I think also, and Julie mentioned this as well, you know, I think this idea of getting around the trickery of a cold reading is something that isn't that hard to do, right? I mean, you don't give out a lot of information, and also the information that comes through, if it's of a very personal nature that no one else could know, you immediately are a convert. And it sounds like, in a lot of ways, that's what happens to Hodgson. So even though he continues to pursue this in a very scientific, rigorous way, and he's a very intelligent guy. That's the other thing that comes through, is these people are not, I don't even want to say they're not inferior to us. You'll read them intellectually. They're probably superior to us in a lot of ways. Certainly their writing and their speaking. I'd hate to have an email exchange with any of these people, because I'd just be embarrassed by my grammar and my language. These were very intelligent people. So here's a guy who has a reading and says, wow, there's something here. I need to investigate it, right? So what happens after that?
Well, after that, they actually signed up Mrs. Piper to a contract and began sitting. Hodgson began sitting with her three times a week on the average, and actually this went for 18 years he sat with her. I mean, outside of a couple of trips she took to England, he had hundreds of sittings with her. He would arrange for other people to come in and sit with her. He would be present. He'd sit there and take notes and record all of this stuff. One of the problems with that type of research is that they didn't really keep count, as Julie Julie has told you probably and told me that, you know, her type of research, you can put some statistical numbers to it. And, you know, you can come out and say 70% correct here and 60% correct here, and chance guessing would only be 5% or whatever, whereas they didn't really do that with Piper. It's just you've got to look at the whole research to see and ask yourself, is it possible that this information could have come through, you know, by pure guessing? One of the big problems was, and William James didn't seem to get this in the research, William James keeps talking about Mrs. Piper fishing for information. But she really wasn't fishing. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is because the scientific writers, they don't really set the foundation for your, you know, give you the background, and they don't tell you enough to know what, you know. It took me about 3 or 4 readings of the SPR records before I began to figure out what was going on. I didn't know the difference between a direct voice medium and a trans voice medium when I first read it, and that was confusing to me.
Tell us what are the differences there?
Trans voice medium is one who the communication actually comes from her mouth. I mean, she goes into a trance, and supposedly the spirit entity takes over her body and speaks right through her own mouth. Where a direct voice, it can be trance or not necessarily trance, but the voice is coming from another part of the room and comes through a trumpet or something that magnifies the voice, and it's totally said that the medium can be sitting there talking to somebody next to her, and the voice is still coming through, and usually 2 or 3 feet above and above her or him, and, you know, off to the right. So it's not coming through the medium herself. The direct voice, or sometimes called independent voice, just comes from some point in the air above the medium. And, you know, I was at that time I was reading this, I was reading some, you know, things about direct voice mediums as well as trans voice, and it just didn't really sink in as to what the difference was. But the biggest thing that they didn't explain was the control aspect. They keep talking about Mrs. Piper's early control was a person called Dr. Finuit, spelled Phinuit. And at times they would say, Dr. Finuit said this. Other times they'd say, Leonora Piper said this. And, you know, it was very confusing. And that whole control process is never really explained. But what happens is that on the other side, the spirit communicators, very few of them are able to speak through mediums for some reason or other. I think they have to put themselves into an altered state of consciousness in order to communicate. And it's like humans trying to meditate. There's only a certain small percentage of humans that are able to effectively meditate. And I think that's the same on the other side. There's only a small percentage of spirits who can put themselves into this altered state of consciousness that allows them to communicate through a medium.
At one point in the book, you talk about mediums on the other side. And again, we should add that this is all just your gleaning this from these reports of these folks. So it's not like you're saying this is true. It's just it's their research that you've gone back and tried to sort through and give us the best you can. But go back to that point that at one point they talk about mediums on the other side. That is mediums, spirit mediums who are helping spirits on the other side connect with the human medium on this side. Do I have that right?
That's right. And that's what they call the control. So the control was the medium on the other side. What the control would do would get the information from the spirit that was communicating. He would then pass it through the medium and then onto the sitter there, so that there was a lot of distortion going on. First of all, apparently the control doesn't receive the information from the communicator, the spirit communicator, verbally, is by thought transference. So a lot of times the control, again, Dr. Finuit being the early control, he had to interpret what the spirits were telling him. And frequently he didn't interpret it correctly, and he would fish. So William James thought Mrs. Piper was fishing, but Dr. Finney was actually occupying Mrs. Finney, or Mrs. Piper's body, and he was doing the fishing. He's trying to figure out, what is this spirit trying to tell me? I'm not getting it clearly. And so he would fish from the spirit, not the sitter. And that's what James never got clearly, or never stated clearly. Where Hodgson and later Dr. James Hislop, who succeeded Hodgson, they saw it very clear that, you know, Mrs. Piper's not fishing. It's the spirit control who's fishing for information.
You know, Mike, you've mentioned William James now a couple times in less than glowing terms, which he's always referred to. And you wrote an interesting blog post a while back that I remember. The title really sticks in my head. It's, you know, was William James a wimp? And I'd like to go into that for a minute, because I think you come to the conclusion that William James, although he stepped into this territory that was just, even at the time, toxic in terms of career-wise to kind of go there, and he was brave enough to go there, he maybe didn't go as far as he could have in terms of advancing this whole area and elevating it to a scientific level that would change the world more. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, he didn't want to have his reputation damaged by coming out and saying, yes, I believe in spirits, and spirits are communicating. That might have ended his academic career. And even today, as you know, Julie and many others will tell you that, you know, if you start talking about spirits in an academic setting, you're risking losing your job. And it was much more so, I guess, back then. So he had to sort of sit on the fence. I mean, I think reading between the lines with William James, I think he believed in spirits. He made a number of statements that said he was leaning in that direction. But he didn't come directly out like Hodgson and Hislop and Sir Oliver Lodge and Frederick Myers. I mean, they all started as skeptics. And at some point in time, they says, okay, I've got enough. I now believe that spirits are communicating with us. I believe in life after death. James never said that. He just continued to sit on the fence the whole time.
I think there's two ways that a lot of times it seems like these researchers want to go. One is to kind of play it tight to the vest, like William James did. And you can almost, in reading between the lines, read this assumption that they have that, you know, in the long run, this will play out. There's enough evidence behind this. I don't need to stick my neck out all the way. It's just going to get chopped off. It won't advance the cause. Let me kind of play this middle ground here, even though that's not what I really believe. In the long run, that'll get us closer. And the other person is just kind of the convert who says, "What? Why we can't kind of live in this world of Hall of Mirrors where we don't say what we've really found and we need to come out and report it." Don't you see that same thing kind of going on today? And I guess you can make a case for either one. I mean, sometimes if the public at large isn't ready to accept an idea, maybe it isn't best to go out with it too boldly.
Yeah, I think we just keep reinventing the wheel. To give you an example, I was at, there's an anthology of spiritual things being put together by a professor in Northern California, and I was asked to write a 5,000-word essay on ectoplasm. So I put it together and sent it to the professor, and he said, it's not balanced enough. You got to put more of the skeptic's view into it. And I pointed out to him that you know, the researchers that I cited, which were Roche and Gustav Geely and Schrenk Notzing and all those who did a lot of research with mediums who were giving off ectoplasm, they started as skeptics. They had already ruled out the skeptical side of it. So why do I have to bring in skeptics who saw it only one time or had this idea that it wasn't true because there's no natural cause for it or whatever? And I said, it's already been, you know, addressed. And it's this need for balance.
It's a false balance. It's an artificial balance. And it's really a sleight of hand in kind of turning science on its head. It's the Dr. Richard Wiseman quote that says, hey, ESP has been proven by the normal standards of science, but that raises the question, do we need a different standard? And I think that's that gets repeated over and over again. You know, I guess I'd pull back from that and ask about the purpose of your book in general, because, you know, Mike, you've done just a yeoman's job of chronicling this aspect of history, looking at it in a number of different ways that no one else has pulled together. You have an interesting perspective in this book, Resurrecting Lenora Piper. You know, I think there's two ways we can look at all this information about this period. We can look at it in terms of forgotten history, which is, I think, the angle that you take. You know, if only we would go back and an honest person, would open-minded person, would look at this data, it's pretty hard not to be extremely aware that there's a significant amount of this history that's been lost. But I gotta wonder if there isn't a totally different way of looking at this history. And that's almost like a textbook game plan for the kind of scientism, for the kind of spirit of denial that we live in today. I mean, it's almost like, hey, if you want to look at how to take overwhelmingly significant evidence and bury it, sweep it under the rug, and embarrass all the people who've touched it, hey, here's the way to get, here's the way to do it. Just go back and look at this part of history.
I agree. I mean, that's one of the reasons I wrote this book and four other books that I've written, is to try and resurrect this stuff because it's so little known. I know a number of parapsychologists, or, you know, I've talked to a number of parapsychologists, and they don't know it themselves. That, you know, I remember one who didn't even know who Frederick Myers was. And you talk about Leonora Piper or Sir Oliver Lodge or Gladys Osborne Leonard, and they're all names they recognize, but they don't know any of the history. I don't know what they teach them when they're, you know, pursuing their degrees in parapsychology, but they seem to escape the or avoid the early stuff.
Well, parapsychology, formally as it's taught, has become really anomalous psychology. It's why people believe weird things. I mean, that's where parapsychology is really being taken. So it's not surprising that they're not interested in history. But it's from another perspective, it is interesting how we, in our modern age, in our iPhone internet age, feel a complete disconnect with even this history that's a little more than 100 years ago. One of the things that I think your book does a great job of doing is connecting us with that time period and connecting us with the events that have gone on since then that become really just smaller stepping stones that we can see how the path has gone. That's how I felt from the book. I felt, you know what? I'm really not that much different than these people. I don't know how anyone could have done it any different than they did. So what are your thoughts on our connection or our lack of connection with this time period?
Well, I agree with you that it's, you know, most of this has been filed away in dust-covered cabinets, and people just don't know about it. And part of the reason is not only because of the scientific fundamentalists, but the religious fundamentalists. They oppose it as much as the scientific fundamentalists. They, you know, read things in the Old Testament that the dead know nothing, and, you know, stay away from speaking with the dead and so forth. And so you got the scientific fundamentalists on one side, the religious fundamentalists on the other side, and not much left in the middle. And that's why we don't know about it today. I have a very good friend who's a lawyer. He's a born-again Christian. You know, when I start talking to him about this, he thinks I'm, you know, representing the devil. I mean, he fears for my salvation because I believe that you can communicate with spirits. This guy's a lawyer. I mean, he's almost a judge.
You've chronicled this history, and you've really gone much further than the book Resurrecting Lenora Piper. Are you a believer in a pattern? Is there a direction that this is going in? Is it being directed by someone or something?
Well, I think the early spirit communication was directed by the spirits themselves. There were messages coming through through a number of very credible mediums that indicated that Benjamin Franklin working with Emanuel Swedenborg, is the one who figured out how to communicate by means of raps. Whatever it took to get these raps through from the other side, it was Ben Franklin and Emanuel Swedenborg who figured it out. And there were a number of other messages indicating that there was a hierarchy of spirits there on the other side who were directing this. And at some point, the problem was that the higher spirits have a more difficult time communicating with us than the lower spirits because they're at a very much higher vibration level. So they have to come down through these various levels of vibration, and they have to use lower level spirits to get through to us. And there was one message that came through from Imperator. He was a supposedly high spirit that communicated with William Staten Moses back during the 1880s. And he says, we misjudged. We thought we would be able to get this information through better than we have. We didn't realize there was going to be so much interference in the lower levels among the spirits and so much rejection by your scientists or asking for better explanations. So there were indications they pulled back. They were beginning to pull back, after that. And I think that's what happened. I think they just said, there's no point. There was a lot of physical mediumship going on, and many genuine mediums were being disparaged, called cheats, because people didn't understand what was going on. It was just beyond their comprehension that these ectoplasm and materialized beings emerging out of this ectoplasm. And in the meantime, there were actual frauds that became involved, and people couldn't tell the difference between the frauds and the genuine mediums. And so I think the spirit world pulled back.
That explanation always feels a little bit hollow. I don't know if it's true. It may be true, but it feels a little bit lacking, in the same way that, I've started to delve into a little bit the extraterrestrial hypothesis, because again, it's this area where there's an overwhelming amount of evidence for a long period of time. And many credible people have come forward and said, hey, this has happened. There's this extended consciousness. We connect with these other beings. And then you have the whole psychedelic field, and their research matches up with that. And you have the DMT stuff and Dr. Rick Strassman and people in the Amazon who are seeing aliens the same way that these people are seeing aliens. There's this whole body of extended consciousness. And you, again, run into the same kind of problem, which is, if there's this extended consciousness of other beings, we'll call them aliens, why aren't they landing on the White House lawn? And we could say the same thing with our spirits here. They're really so limited that they can't communicate with us in a more effective way. We have all these folks that come forward as channelers or as people who have had this special connection with these spirits and say, hey, here it is. Here's everything you need to know. And they're often contradictory. One contradicts another. I just talked to Chris Carter. He's written an excellent book. And in there, part of our conversation, he says, hey, I've come to the conclusion that we reincarnate 3 to 4 times, because one of the sources that he had he felt was very credible, and that was their information. Well, that idea is contradicted by, any number of near-death experience accounts, medium accounts, and other Gnostic texts that will tell you that that's not at all true. So those are the kind of explanations that, even for the open-minded person, I think creates a lot of confusion, a lot of uncertainty. Do you know where I'm heading there?
I understand that. But, the other thing I was going to say is that, I'm not sure that we're supposed to know, with certainty. I think,
right.
The one quote that I've cited a number of times in several of my books comes from Victor Hugo's research back in the 1850s. He was sitting with a number of mediums, and he asked whoever he's communicating with through this one medium, he asked, why is it so difficult? Why doesn't God better reveal himself? And
right.
It was Martin Luther, supposedly Martin Luther, that was communicating with him at the time. And Martin Luther replied, he says, because doubt is the instrument which forges the human spirit. If the day were to come when the human spirit no longer doubted, the human soul would fly off and leave the plow behind, for it would have required acquired wings. The earth would be fallow. Now God is the sower and man is the harvester. The celestial seed demands that the human plowshare remain in the furrow of life. So in effect, what he was saying is that we have to, you know, if we knew everything for sure, it would take away a lot of the challenges of the reason we're here, living this earth life, and it would hinder our progress. So I guess that's the answer, that we're not meant to know for sure, but we can at least have some assurance. I keep saying, you know, we're never going to get absolute proof that consciousness survives death, but we can at least move up to the 99% belief level.
Yeah, fair enough. I wonder if we don't also run into a problem when we put we in there instead of I. One of the conclusions I've come to is that this is about each person's personal journey, soul journey, if you want to go there, but just your journey through understanding and advancing yourself and trying to understand. So I often wonder if when we start saying we and start generalizing and saying this is how all people are, I don't know. I don't know how anyone else is. I'm on my own little path, my own little journey, and it may be relatable to you and to other people, but it may just be the way God, for lack of a better term, has set things up to play out for me.
I think so. I agree.
Well, Mike, it's been great. This is a great book that people should really check out. Again, it's Resurrecting Lenora Piper, How Science Discovered the Afterlife. It's fascinating to just discover these great minds and how they handled some of the same questions that we seem to be wrestling with over and over again today. So a great book, and thanks so much for joining me, Mike.
Thanks very much for having me on, Alex. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to Mike Tim for joining me today on Skeptico. A couple of questions I'd tee up for you that we might want to discuss. The first, obviously, is what do you make of Lenora Piper? Was she really tapping into a spiritual dimension beyond this world that allowed her to communicate with the dead? I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming, and I think it's especially interesting to look at the testing and challenging that they did of her abilities and the extent to which she withstood that testing. So I'd be interested to see what you think, if you think she was properly tested and if you think she withstood those tests. And the second question I'd offer up, and I guess you probably saw this coming, is what does this episode in history mean to us right now in terms of this push for a paradigm change, or this push towards an evolution in consciousness, or this sense of moving forward? And I guess there's really two sub-questions that go with that. The first is, hey, haven't we been there before? Anyone who thinks we're at the cusp of some kind of paradigm change needs to go back and look at this part of history and see how you can get pretty darn close and then you can fall back down into the materialistic abyss. And the second part of the sub-question of that is, where do we get the arrogance to think that we know so much, or that we're discovering anything? Are we so mesmerized with our little toys and gadgets that we can't step back and look at how inadequately we've addressed the biggest, most important scientific questions, and that the underlying reason we've been so inadequate is because we've been willfully ignorant and willfully blind of answering those questions? Okay, now I don't know how anyone is going to unravel that and answer that as one question, but you can just do your best and we'll see what you come up with. Of course, the place to do that and to respond and to share with me your thoughts is on the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can do so by adding a comment right there on the website or clicking on over to the forum and joining a discussion over there. While there, you can also check out our over 200 previous episodes of Skeptico. They're all there on the past shows page. And you can also connect with me and drop me an email or connect with me on Facebook. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptico. Many interesting shows in the hopper, going a number of different directions. They're all fun and exciting for me, and I hope you'll enjoy them too. Until next time, take care and bye for now.